arranged by David Matthews and played by the Nash Ensemble. Well, that's it for this week's programme. So glad you could join me. Next week from 10 o'clock, my theme is Scenes from Childhood. That's music suitable for children of all ages, I hasten to add. And after 11, the first of a series here on the programme of one-movement symphonies. Certainly not for the kids, this one. Scriabin's fourth, his Poem of Ecstasy, conducted by Riccardo Muti. So please do join me, same time, 9 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
On BBC Two, Professor Brian Cox looks at life's place in the universe in a brand new series.
What is it that animates living things? What is the difference between a piece of rock and me? Life is a process. It's the interaction between matter and energy described by the laws of physics and chemistry, the same laws that describe the falling of the rain or the shining of the stars.
There's always more to see on BBC Two. Wonders of Life starts tonight at 9.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Lucy Hughes Hallett is the author of the much-acclaimed Cleopatra, Queen, Lover, Legend. Her most recent book is The Pike, the life of Gabrielle D'Annunzio, poet, seducer and preacher of war. Why the pike?
Well, one of his friends described him as being like a pike, and I don't know much about fish, but apparently what pike do is they lurk in shallow water, waiting for sort of delicious things to float past on the stream and then grab whatever's going by that they can use.
They're predators.
They're predators, exactly. Mm. Snappers up of unconsidered trifles. And D'Annunzio, one of the things that made him very interesting to me is that he had a fantastic sort of nose for the zeitgeist. He was very quick to pick up any kind of intellectual trend or even a new literary form, so that in writing about him, I could write about his era.
What do you think his importance was?
Well, he saw himself as a kind of Nietzschean Superman. And indeed, he was one of the few people who took that concept out of the library and enacted it on the kind of world stage when he made himself dictator of his little city-state in Fiume, or Rijeka, as it's now called. When end of the First World War, 1919, Europe in chaos, D'Annunzio thought that Fiume should be part of Italy. Nobody was going to give it to Italy, and so he marched there himself and turned it into his own little place where he lived the life of a superman.
I was very fascinated reading the book because I could see why it would appeal to a writer. I mean, in particular, of course, he was a notorious seducer, wasn't he?
He certainly was, yes. Bernard Berenson, who was his neighbour in the Florentine Hills for several years, Berenson didn't like D'Annunzio at all, but he said of him that it was possible to have a decent conversation with him as long as there were no women in the room. But as soon as a woman walked in, D'Annunzio would sort of switch into seduction mode and start to, in Berenson's eye, behaving in the most preposterous fashion.
But not without success.
With enormous success. By all accounts, it's rather odd because you look at photographs, he actually looks perfectly pleasant looking. But a lot of his contemporaries describe him as being grotesquely ugly. But nonetheless, he was also fantastically seductive. And his women included Eleonora Duse, the greatest actress of her generation, with the possible exception of Sarah Bernhardt, with whom I believe he also had a quick fling, although that's not so well documented.
Now, I know that you love music, because I've often seen you at operas and concerts. Did this go back a long way, your fondness for music?
Yes, it does, in a very untutored way. I think I didn't really start listening to music properly until I was in my 20s, apart from pop music, which we'll get onto. Mm. but I always rather loved going to church. And I'm not a believer of any kind, but I still like going to church for the architecture and for the music. And a rather sort of wretched, boring school life at boarding school was greatly relieved by, you know, school chapel every morning and hymns and anthems. And actually, I still sing hymns when I'm bicycling.
And this first music was, I think you were in Paris at Easter and actually went into a church.
That's right, yes. Saint-Julien-le-Pauvre, which is the church right on the river, a very old church, which is now the centre for the Melkite Christians, where they perform the Eastern Rite, which is one of the oldest forms of the Christian liturgy. And I went there on an Easter Saturday. This is many years ago. I was in Paris with my husband, Dan Franklin. And we heard a male voice choir intoning the rite for Easter Saturday, which is very solemn. Christ's in the tomb. And as I understand it, when I may have misunderstood, they're basically singing to keep him alive, and they have to keep on singing until Easter Day dawns, and then there's a great shout for he is risen. Sometime after that visit to Paris, I was told about Sir Marie Kérouse by my friend John Hatt, the great traveller, who gave me a tape, and I thought it was wonderful. And it's a very ancient form of Christian sacred music, which I think if you just heard it casually, you would assume was not Christian at all, because it's Middle Eastern music. I suppose part of what I like about this music, apart from its extreme beauty to my ear, is that it's a kind of reminder that the religions that are now so often at loggerheads with each other, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they all come from the same place, the same geographical place, which seems somehow a sort of a hopeful omen that someday we can all make friends again.
Thank you.
Fascinating, that drone, which, after all, is what you also get on in Scotland with the bagpipes. You get a melody over a drone. And it has a strangely hypnotic effect, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. And the way the voice swoops up and above it is very compelling. And it's curiously sort of unearthly, inhuman almost. It has a sort of angelic sound.
We heard Holy Thursday from the Byzantine chant. Sister Marie Cayrouse was singing with the choir of Saint-Julien Le Pauvre in Paris. Now, Lucy Hughes-Hallett, there's a rather nice mixture of music, indeed quite often in your choice, with the books you've written. And I imagine that's partially because when you're writing something like D'Annunzio or Cleopatra or Heroes, you absolutely immerse yourself in the architecture, the music, the culture, the cooking, the sense of place that these figures inhabited.
Yes, it's true. In fact, I mean, my D'Annunzio book is comparatively constrained. I mean, both my first two books, Cleopatra and Heroes, cover over 2,000 years. And when I finished Cleopatra, I thought I've learnt my lesson here, because although the first chapter of that book is a sort of, as it were, historical biography, the rest of it is examination of the way Cleopatra has been represented subsequently over many, many centuries.
Unfairly, you say?
Mostly very unfairly, yes. And I did swear to myself that, you know, next time round I would pick a subject which had a limited time span. But then I started on Heroes and found myself beginning with the Trojan War and ending in the 20th century, so I didn't learn my lesson there.
But D'Annunzio takes you nicely to Monteverdi.
Certainly does, yes, because although there was a great deal that was deplorable about D'Annunzio, he did some good things. And he was a sort of conservationist, before the word was really current, mainly for reasons connected with his highly questionable politics. He wanted to glorify Italy by preserving and bringing back to the light the glories of Italy's past that had been forgotten. And a lot of Monteverdi's music had, as it were, sort of dropped out of the repertoire. And D'Annunzio was living in Venice through the First World War, and having an affair, being D'Annunzio, with a lady who lived in the Palazzo Vidal, just along the Grand Canal, indeed, from where he was living. And her husband, who seems to have been surprisingly tolerant of the situation, was a famous collector of musical manuscripts. And so D'Annunzio, when not meeting his wife clandestinely, was enjoying the run of his library. And between them, they discovered various pieces of Monteverdi's music which hadn't been seen for a long time. But Orfeo, of course, actually had been revived before D'Annunzio moved into Venice. But I chose this particular scene from it because I love the drama of it. Orfeo, Orpheus, has just been singing about how happy he is and how wonderful that, you know, his long and anguished love for Eurydice has finally come to happy fruition, and they're going to live happily ever after. And he's been singing away, tra-la-la. And then in the bit we're about to hear, in comes the messenger, who is in fact a friend of Eurydice's, who has seen her die. And Orfeo seems to know that immediately, before the messenger has even delivered the terrible news. And there's a wonderful reticence in his response. He gets to sing a sort of an aria of lamentation later, but at this point he just sings, "Alas, oime." And that silence, that non-verbal grief, is almost more moving than if he'd sort of let out a great lament at this point. De mira Orfeo, che d'ogni intorno rida il bosco e rida il prato, se qui pur col pletro.
suono lente il lieto ti perturba. Thank you.
We heard music from Act Two of Monteverdi's Orfeo. Jennifer Larmor sang the messenger Lawrence Dale Orfeo with concerto vocale directed by René Jacobs. We talked about Cleopatra, and I noticed some of the little byways as well as the highways that you obviously enjoyed going down. There's mythology, of course, but there's also things like details of what was the asp that we always see in pictures. And you do a rather nice few paragraphs where you dissect what might have been the creature that did for Cleopatra.
Yes, well, of course, painters loved painting Cleopatra with the asp clasped to her bosom because that was an excuse for painting a topless lady. And so it's a very popular subject with Renaissance artists. And actually, Sir Thomas Browne listed it as one of the kind of, I can't remember what he calls them, popular errors frequently made, that the asp is a pretty little, often rather sort of gilded-looking...
Almost like a piece of jewellery.
Exactly. Whereas, in fact, and I spent, I can remember, a couple of days in the library at the Wellcome Foundation looking at horrific pictures of snakebite victims and discovering that in order to have killed Cleopatra and at least one of her waiting women, the asp, which was probably a kind of cobra, would have had to have been about 6 foot long.
Difficult to smuggle in.
Yes. And, of course, all the ancient sources tell us that rather than stripping bare for her death, Cleopatra actually put on all her clothes. She called for her all her royal robes and her cobra-shaped headdress so that she would die in her persona as great queen and incarnation of the goddess Isis.
And rather than the Italian vipore, you suspect that it would have been a more kindly venom that she would have chosen for herself.
Yes. In fact, death by cobra bite was apparently a sort of fairly common form of capital punishment in Alexandria at the time because it induces sort of gradual paralysis.
Do you think that Handel got Cleopatra right? Because, of course, as you were saying earlier, she has been much vilified and demonised as this seductress and... almost female D'Annunzio.
Well, I don't know whether he got her right. It's very hard to know what Cleopatra was really like. But certainly Handel's Cleopatra is a much more positive representation than 99% of the ones I came across. Most depictions of Cleopatra, whether visual or literary, are riddled with racism and misogyny and anxiety about the whole idea of a woman holding power. Or there are these lurid fantasies about femme fatale. And whereas the Cleopatra of Handel's opera is a spirited, beautiful young woman. She's rather given to sort of dressing up and pretending to be different people for no very good reason that I can really quite follow. But
well,
you know, operas
she's
like
in
that.
An opera, yes.
So in the aria we're about to hear, she's pretending to be a servant, dressing up as a goddess. So she's sort of doubly disguised. But never mind, she's still a self-confident girl, delighted by the fact that she seems to be successfully bewitching the most powerful man in the world,
Julius Caesar.
Offesa, ma fa non credi in mora, scavetella.
V'adoro pupille, from Julius Caesar, Act 2, Scene 2, by Handel. It's quite fascinating how the different translations offer the words in French. In the translation there, it's Je vous adore Prunelle. It somehow sounds slightly wrong. But there is a kind of wonderful energy to the lyricism of that music.
Yes, there is, isn't there? Exactly. Is it great?
I mean, it's a love song, but it has so much life in it.
Yes, and a sort of a feeling of youth. And of course, Cleopatra was probably about 18 when she met Julius Caesar, so it's appropriate that she'd have that exuberance.
Well, she was sung there by Barbara Schlick with Concerto Köln, directed by René Jacobs once again. Lucy Hughes-Hallett, I think in Verdi's Otello, despite your aspirations to be Shakespeare, you feel that he might have gone one better than the Bard.
Yes, it does almost seem blasphemous to say it, but I think that Verdi did improve on Shakespeare's narrative structure anyway, because in Shakespeare's Othello, there is a strong pantomime-ish feeling of kind of look behind you, now how can Othello be so gullible? Whereas the plot remains the same in Verdi's version, but it's given a much sort of tighter narrative structure. But this scene we're going to listen to, it's love music. It's music that's sort of swooning, and we swoon listening to it. It's so beautiful, and both the characters seem to be swooning. But even so, in the middle of it, there comes a point when Otello sings, can't remember what the Italian is, but it's the equivalent of the Shakespearean line, "If it were now to die, 'twere to be now most happy." And of course, we know that's true. You know, it can only get worse from now on. This is the moment of their most perfect rapture. And as he sings that, there's just a little theme in the background, sort of punctuating the swoon of the rest of the music.
Verdi's wonderful at doing that, isn't he? Of just giving you that little slight prod.
Yes.
To remind you that there's something else going on.
Yes. The other passage that I thought of including, but we couldn't have too much Verdi, was the scene from Rigoletto, where Rigoletto meets Sparafucile, the assassin. And it's a most terrifying scene. It's a temptation scene, and I rather, actually, as with Iago tempting Otello, Rigoletto almost immediately it seems to accept the suggestion that, yes, maybe assassinating the Duke would be a good idea. But that very, very frightening scene is sung over a very pretty little daddy-daddy tune, which actually makes it far more frightening than more doomy sort of music would.
I think that's where Verdi, and indeed Puccini, in a sense, moved music on. Because if you think that even in Donizetti and Bellini, that quite awful things were accompanied by you know, so there was a kind of almost a convention in music that people would sing about rather dreadful emotions to rather cheerful music. And I think that Verdi moved that on dramatically, quite considerably, and in fact actually doctored it to his own ends.
I remember when I was a child, I had a recurring nightmare from which I would wake up screaming, in which somebody said something, and I could never remember what the something was, but it was something truly terrible. But it was said in a very merry, kindly voice, and that was what was so awful about the nightmare.
Yeah.
Extraordinary how, even within that rapturous duet, there is somehow the potential on her part as being vulnerable and a victim, and on his part, the potential for freneticism and jealousy. You can hear it nudging.
Yes, I don't quite know how it's conveyed, but there is the sense of all the drama yet to come. And I think those two voices I particularly like.
I was going to say to you, because there is in Vickers, of course, I can't help thinking also of the slightly driven craziness of Peter Grimes, which he also did, but there is in his voice that ability. Although he was able to float those notes at the end, and she does. So it's a very good recording, I think.
Yes, and both of their voices are somehow hard. I mean, there's something very, as I say, swoony and voluptuous about that music. But those two voices, both of them, there's a kind of refinement and a reticence to them that somehow stops it becoming too soupy, I think.
And they're quintessentially male and female, too, of course.
Yes, yes.
We heard Mirella Freni singing Desdemona and John Vickers' Otello in music from Act 1, Scene 3 of Verdi's opera, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Your next music, Lucy Hughes Hallett, I know you've chosen because you think they're some of the greatest lyrics ever written.
You're teasing me. But yes, the Rolling Stones is sort of almost where I start music. I wasn't cool enough, but my sort of best friend when I was 10 or 11 bought Not Fade Away. It was the first single that either of us had ever owned, and it was very exciting, which means that I came of age, if being 11 is coming of age, which I think it is in this context, in the sort of the great age of British pop music. So through the next few years, I was listening to the Rolling Stones all the time. And also the Animals, them, the Yardbirds, all sorts of British bands who were playing music influenced by Black American music and it was all very exciting. And I loved it, and I really could have chosen almost any Rolling Stones song, any early ones anyway, I loved them. And it gives me great pleasure that my daughters listen to them now and seem to enjoy them just as much. But I chose this one particularly because the lyrics are so very contentious. It's Under My Thumb. It's a kind of anthem to male triumphalism. And as a woman and a feminist, I should find it abhorrent. But
it was part of that strutting precociousness, wasn't it?
And something that I've written about a lot, and in a way it's one of the dominant themes of all three of my books, is the idea that you don't have to admire something, you certainly don't have to approve of it, in order to find it attractive and exciting. And so the persona, which I'm sure isn't really Mick Jagger, but the person speaking in this song, is a shocking fellow. We shouldn't approve of him at all. But that gives the song, I think, a bit of the extra frisson, and it's so defiant and it's so snarly. And
he's a rake. He's a latter-day Tom Rake, or something.
Exactly.
Under My Thumb by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones. Well, our last piece, Lucy, is by Debussy, but it also has a connection with the book which you've just brought out.
It does, yes. We're back with D'Annunzio. And D'Annunzio had a thing about Saint Sebastian from quite early on in his life. He at one point was in the gardens of the Villa Medici in Rome with one of his mistresses. And they'd had a sort of passionate sexual session the previous afternoon, which had left him scarred. She'd been biting him all over. Mm. And it was a hot night. He stripped off some of his clothes and posed against an olive tree in this wonderful Renaissance garden, and asked her to guess who he was. And the answer was he was being Saint Sebastian transfixed by arrows. And this became a game which he played with a lot of his subsequent lovers as well. And anyway, finally, when he was living in Paris in the early 20th century, he went there in 1910 and almost immediately started work on this music drama in which he collaborated with Debussy. And Saint Sebastian, in this, The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian, was played by Ida Rubinstein, who was part of Diaghilev's entourage. In fact, no, not entourage. She was an heiress, a very wealthy Russian woman.
She financed his entourage.
She did indeed, yes. So rather than being a Tagaron, he was more of a Tagaron of hers. D'Annunzio first saw her, and here we sort of, you know, circle back to another of my subjects, when she was appearing in his ballet of Cleopatra, although she couldn't dance. And D'Annunzio then decided that she should be Saint Sebastian, even though she couldn't act either. But although she could neither dance nor speak very well, she did apparently have a terrific stage presence. And so she was respected for her abilities as a mime. And so D'Annunzio concocted this rather curious hybrid work, which is really a sort of a lot of declamation with incidental music.
It's got wonderful things in it, but I've always had problems with it as a whole.
Yes, well, it's very, very long and not very dramatic, which is true of a lot of D'Annunzio's playwriting. And its first performances in Paris were not really huge successes, but Debussy's music was always well received. And apparently Debussy himself was so moved by it on the first night, he was seen to be in tears at the beauty of his own choruses.
Thank you.
Gloire from the fifth window, Paradise, of Debussy's The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. We heard Felicia Montealegre singing The Saint with the Choral Arts Society and the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Thank you very much, Lucy Hughes-Hallett, for introducing us to this music, which I cannot help observing is all vocal.
Yes. I suppose I was going to the theatre before I was listening to music, so that in a lot of these examples, as you'll see, I love the music, but I'm slightly hearing them as drama as well.
And also perhaps as a writer, the input of words is important, even if you don't always like the words.
Perhaps, although actually in a lot of these instances, I'm hearing the words as almost abstract sound. And I think that would be obviously particularly true with the Sister Mary Carew's work. You know, I don't understand Arabic. So although I get the gist of what's being sung, I think really I do find the human voice one of the most beautiful of instruments and most flexible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this enormously.
Lucy Hughes-Hallett was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be Sir George Young MP. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
The BBC Radio 3 World Roots Academy, supporting and inspiring young UK-based world music artists by bringing them together with an internationally respected musician in the same tradition.
It just changed the way I play as well. You know, I just felt a difference instantly.
And joining them to explore the land of their music's birth.
It was great. It was a great night. And they played together for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 hours.
Join us as we introduce the 2013 World Roots Academy protégé in front of a lively audience at the Radio Theatre in London. Tonight at 10 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's a minute past one. Time now for the news read by David Cornett.
Local media in southern Brazil are reporting that at least 90 people have died at a fire in a nightclub in the city of Santa Maria in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. Some reports say the fire broke out where musicians set off fireworks on stage. Most of the victims are believed to be students. French-led forces in Mali are advancing on the historic city of Timbuktu, which Islamist militants captured in April last year. Yesterday, French and Malian forces retook control of the rebel stronghold of Gao. The African Union is meeting in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, to discuss the crisis. England's Chief Inspector of Schools, Sir Michael Wilshaw, has ordered a landmark report into how state schools teach the most able pupils. Sir Michael says some children who get top marks at primary school are not reaching their potential when they get to secondary school. He fears that bright pupils are left to coast or are entered too early for GCSE exams in order to gain the minimum C grades required for league tables. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has said it's not in the national interest to have a debate about Britain's membership of the European Union. He said jobs and growth in the UK could be hit if investors weren't sure about the country's future relationship with the EU. The Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has told the BBC she remains fond of the country's army, which was founded by her father, even though it kept her under house arrest for 15 years. Speaking on Desert Island Discs, Ms. Suu Kyi said the army had done terrible things in Burma, but she still thought of it as her father's army and hoped it would redeem itself. Tennis, Andy Murray has lost to the world's number one, Novak Djokovic, in the final of the Australian Open in Melbourne. Murray took the first set but lost the next three, the second to a tiebreak. And the weather, heavy showers will continue to affect most western parts of the country. Some of them will be wintry, especially on hills. It'll remain largely dry in eastern areas with clear spells developing. Strong winds will persist in northern and western areas. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by David Cornett. Time now on Radio 3 for today's edition of the Early Music Show. It's presented by Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. If, like me, you enjoy a bit of celebrity gossip, you'll have probably noticed that the larger-than-life French actor Gérard Depardieu has been in the news quite a bit recently, although not always for his acting. His hulky but hugely attractive presence has graced lots of movies over the years, from his native France to Hollywood. But I wonder if any of you recall the particularly atmospheric film Tous les matins du monde, released in 1991, where he played the 17th century French musician Marin Marais. It was an extraordinarily poignant film which traced the relationship between Marais and his somewhat dour teacher, Monsieur de Sainte-Colombe. And unusually, alongside its modern soundtrack, it featured real early music, original pieces composed by both Marais and Sainte-Colombe, performed by one of today's most celebrated viol players, Jordi Savall, with his ensemble. Just how much the contrasting characters of master and pupil and the interweaving of their lives, as portrayed in the film, were based on reality, we can't be sure. The solitary and slightly mysterious Sainte-Colombe and the more gregarious Marais. But both were extremely accomplished players of the viol de gamba, who've left us with some beautiful compositions. And in today's programme, we'll be exploring a bit more about them and hearing some of the music from the film. One thing the film manages to do brilliantly is to capture the noble, almost devotional pursuit of music, and in particular that of the viol, an instrument that features prominently in Marais's most famous work, Sonnerie de Sainte-Geneviève de Mont de Paris. In fact, this is the piece that opens the film in a flash forward as Marais, now an old man, at the peak of his success at the royal court and acclaimed throughout France and beyond, reflects with some emotion on his early life. "I had a master," he murmurs to himself. "He had austerity, he had rage, and the shadows took him away."